This is the Monday Morning Quarterback Podcast with Andy Benoit and your host, John Engel.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Monday Morning Quarterback Podcast. I'm John Engel at Engel's Engel on Twitter, here with Andy Benoit at Andy_Benoit. Later in the show, we'll have an interview with Luke Kuechly, inside linebacker for the Panthers. We'll get to that in a little bit. Andy, welcome back from the Super Bowl. It's good to see you again. It's been a few weeks.
Yeah, it's nice to see your face. It does help to be in the studio, to see your face.
Yeah, you almost said it's nice to see your face, but then you retracted.
Well, because I thought it would come out kind of smarmy.
Are there any, I was just thinking of this, are there any common nicknames already laid out for Luke Kuechly? Because I'm sure there should be a few.
Well, because he has the Luke, you know, Luke, which I think is stupid.
See, I have a buddy who calls him Freakly, and I think that's incredible.
Well, really like that?
Yeah, why not? Because he's a freak.
I think that's stupid.
You do?
Certain superstars are bigger than their nicknames. Like J.J. Watt, you know, we call him J.J. Swat, but nobody goes around calling him that predominantly.
I think Freakly is just fun. Rolls off the tongue.
Do you remember when that name came on the scene? It was Javon Curse in 1999 for the Titans. And he was a dominant, you know, I mean, most people remember Javon Curse.
Right.
And they called him the Freak. And that was before people hadn't really taken, Freak was not a positive term until around that time. Little etymology for you.
Yeah,
well,
now that we have the origins of the word Freak. Hey, earlier this week, we shared some initial impressions from Super Bowl 49. Has your impression of or perception of the goal line interception changed since watching the film?
Not really. I was kind of hoping it would, because that'd be another article that would, you know, get thousands and thousands of clicks for free on it. I could write something clever, but there was nothing on the film that wasn't. In fact, I wound up clicking the broadcast version because they had better angles on it anyway. I thought perhaps I watched the game, like the end of the game when I got home. I flew back home and got home last night. I put on the end of the game. Curious what they had said about it. And I thought Lockett maybe slowed his route down when I watched it initially, like in that replay. But then when I watched him put on the film, I don't think that's fair to say. I think Russell Wilson's ball placement wasn't ideal, but more than that, more than anything, Butler knew the play and he jumped the route and he was a perfect defensive play.
So this was more Malcolm Butler. It wasn't Russell Wilson. It wasn't maybe Brown and Bronner holding on to Jermaine.
See, there it was. That was my plan all along.
Yeah, you've trapped me already.
It was all of those things. I mean, it's a combination of things, because the timing of the play was compromised a little bit by Curse not getting off a Browner's jam. But you know, when I saw the end zone angle of it, I could see what Russell Wilson saw. It looked initially like it was going to be wide open. And I wonder if Wilson did not have a view of Butler. Not that he would have pulled it down, because it's such quick timing that the decision to throw was probably made before the snap even. I mean, it's a one-step drop and throw. So I don't know if he would have pulled it down. But I could see from Wilson's perspective, it may have been a different look than what it appeared on TV.
Are you still confident that not calling the timeout, Bill Belichick, was a bad idea?
Yeah. Yeah. The results don't change the idea. I thought it was a bad idea at the time, because it was a bad idea, and it just happened to work out. But if he does that 10 times, it's not going to work out more than twice for him. This just happened to be one of the two. And I still like Daryl Bevel's play call. I mean, I don't like the play, but I don't have a problem with the play call, because it goes back to mathematics. They had to throw once out of those three plays, and he figured, let's throw up front. Because if it's incomplete, we get a timeout out of it. I'm guessing that's what he figured. That's sound logic. I mean, that makes sense.
You know, I read an interesting perspective on the whole no timeout call. Bill Simmons, you know, notorious Patriots honk. I mean, there's no secret there. But questioning Bill Belichick, arguably the greatest coach of all time, seems a little weird for all of us on the outside.
And well, what here, did Bill,
stick,
what
stick
did,
with me.
Okay.
So he said, Bill Belichick. Now I'm all crossed up. I got Javon Curse running through my mind.
This is a couple of false starts and a holding penalty in the first series.
So he didn't call the timeout knowing that Seattle was expecting the timeout, wasn't out there in their goal line set, let that come, and thought, I have a better chance at stopping this play than I do scoring in 50 seconds against that defense.
But he don't have a better chance of stopping the play two more times in a row, which is what he would have had to do.
Well, he didn't.
Oh, so Bill Belichick game-planned the interception.
No,
he thought this will be the first time all year that someone gets an interception.
I just thought it was an interesting perspective.
It was a bad decision. It was a bad job. Okay, and so was the kickoff before the two-minute warning, kicking it off deep instead of making them return it.
Okay, that was bad. I'll agree with you on that. In our Super Bowl 49 preview podcast, you expected to see Rob Gronkowski used in the seams a lot, and that wasn't necessarily the case in the game. What did the Seahawks do to cover New England's best offensive weapon?
Well, I think they only threw down the seams to him once, and it came about halfway through the second quarter. It was off of a play-action pass. I believe it was a first-down play-action. And the Seahawks were in zone, and Jeremy Lane was underneath, and so it may have been Maxwell underneath at that point. Someone, a slot defender, was underneath, but then Chancellor picked up Gronkowski over the top, and he played him perfectly, and it was incomplete. We didn't see it again from that, and it's not that Seattle did anything. I mean, that was perfect defense on that play, but it's not that they did anything so much that New England had other ways they wanted to utilize Gronkowski, mainly splitting him outside the numbers. So they got away from their tendencies a little bit. It worked out real well, and it was a smart game plan overall. They did a great job of leveraging outside routes. We talked about shallow passes in the flats. Watching the film, it was extraordinary the way it was a really well-built offensive game plan. And the routes that they used, and Gronkowski was a part of this, they exploited Seattle's man coverage and zone coverage. It almost didn't matter what Seattle was in a lot of the time. When Gronk did get his matchups in man-to-man, though, he took advantage. I mean, they didn't have a guy who could cover Gronkowski.
So is that why the Seahawks went away from that standard base defense that we've seen all season long that wasn't really manipulated much even in the playoffs?
Their standard base being their cover three?
Yeah, the cover three. Yeah.
I don't know why they played more man coverage. I actually saw someone tracked it in NFL Films, and I got to see the numbers. Brady's 50 pass attempts, the Seahawks played a zone concept on 31 of them. Now, for them, zone concepts are often man-to-man outside, though, and if New England's passing attack was taking place outside, it felt like man coverage was more involved in the game. On the other 19 snaps they played straight-up man-to-man, and they got beat on a lot of those. So I don't know why they played more man-to-man. They did that against Green Bay in the second half as well, and it worked out for them pretty well. I mean, they slowed that offense down. They're pretty good in man-to-man, but it's New England's one of the toughest teams in the league to play man-to-man against because they have Gronkowski. He's that miscellaneous matchup guy, the X factor, as people like to say now. And then they have route combinations. They're really good with route combinations and easy releases and concepts that get their guys open by design. We've talked about that all season long. And an easy release, for those who don't know, that's just where you eliminate a defender from the equation by having a route runner run out of the picture. So you lighten the field that way. It's often used in the run game.
We touched on this a bit earlier this week, but let's dive into Seattle's coverage on Gronkowski's second quarter touchdown. Instead of using an outstanding boundary corner like Sherman or going with Maxwell or even Earl Thomas, all-pro safety, Seahawks went with linebacker KJ Wright.
And that's because that's their two-man coverage scenario. So what happened on that play, this is a great example. I'm glad you brought this up again because it looked different on film. Well, it wasn't that – the sequence of plays looked different on film. What happened there is Seattle was in two-man and against a two-minute offense, and two-man is man-to-man across the board with two safeties over the top. So if you just think about that, the safeties are going to be Earl Thomas and Cam Chancellor. Typically, Chancellor is the guy who guards the tight end man-to-man. So if he's playing over the top, somebody else has to take the tight end. And Seattle does not put a cornerback on the tight end in that scenario. You leave yourself a little vulnerable in the run game if you do that, even if it's a two-minute situation. But more than that, in this game, they didn't have any corners anyway because of the injury to Lane.
Yeah, that was huge.
Yeah, it was. I thought Simon played all right. We can talk about that more in a second.
Yeah, we'll get to it.
So anyway, the guy who's left to play Gronkowski is KJ Wright, and it's one-on-one. Now, the extra element on that play is that Shane Vereen had been killing the Seahawks underneath. And on that one, Earl Thomas decided to take Vereen, and Bobby Wagner became a free defender. So they basically switched duties. They didn't switch positions, but Thomas took the running back. You don't see that a lot, by the way. A safety doesn't usually pick up the running back, but we can't analyze with hindsight or access to the results. It makes sense that they would put Thomas on Vereen there because Vereen was the guy that had been beating him. Well, with Thomas on Vereen, I think that changed the safety help concepts a little bit. It was now Chancellor was the only high safety left, and Wagner's still in the middle of the field, so Gronkowski's out wide. There's nobody in position to help KJ Wright at that point. There were three wide receivers on the other side of the field opposite Gronkowski. If you're a safety, if you're Cam Chancellor, you have to play to that side of the field. That's three targets, possible targets, versus one target. It's great design. And New England, I'm sure they knew they'd get a look similar to that, and they got exactly what they wanted on that play. I mean, that was an easy play for Brady. It was a good throw, too.
You just touched on Shane Vereen and his elusiveness out of the backfield. But for those who didn't know, he's used much more in the passing game, and this game was a perfect example of that for the Patriots.
Yeah, and you emailed me some numbers earlier, didn't you?
Yeah, about 11 Vereen? Receptions for 64 yards, but only 4 rushes for 13.
Is that in this game, or was
that's in this game.
He had 11 catches?
11 catches.
Wow. I mean, I would have guessed 7 or 8. I know Edelman had like 7 or 8 or 9 or
he
something.
He had 9.
Gronkowski, how many did he have? He had like 6?
6.
So Brady threw the ball pretty well. Brady spread the ball around. They had great – and those were the three big guys. But Vereen's always been more of a receiving type of back than a running back, and that's unique. And he is extremely good out of their three receiver packages, because not only does he come out of the backfield as a receiver, but he can run routes as a wide receiver. I mean, he can line up in the slot or even out wide, and he's going to get a linebacker on him most of the time.
Offensive coordinator Josh McDaniels used wide receiver Julian Edelman in a lot of different ways too in this one.
Yeah, he did. And Edelman was the beneficiary a lot of the concepts they had to the flats. And sometimes we all saw where Edelman caught the passes. He's such a good short area route runner. I thought his touchdown against Thurald Simon and that short underneath coverage, that was really the only area that Simon looked like a backup to me. I think the further he gets downfield, the better he becomes. He's a long, lanky guy. I was pretty impressed with him, though. I thought he was good earlier this year when he had to play, too.
But most of that game occurred in the underneath. I don't know how you can say he played well if he looked like a backup in the underneath half the game was there.
Well, yeah, but it wasn't all on him, though, John, because the underneath, the beauty of it is that it out-leveraged the defensive concept. So a lot of it was underneath, but Simon had someone downfield to run with, or he had two responsibilities in one zone. I mean, it wasn't just that, well, he's underneath and he plays over there, and so that's the general area. I mean, that's kind of just general charting type stats that don't usually shake out. Well, I'm not getting on you, but we're talking football concepts. Yeah. But Simon, when they did isolate him one-on-one, Edelman beat him badly twice in the end zone. Brady missed the first one. He overthrew him, and I believe Amendola caught a short touchdown after that. It was a great tight window throw on the next play. And then they ran the same exact play, and Edelman beat him again. And that's when that was the game-winning touchdown.
On the other side of the ball, the Seattle receivers had a pretty tough time releasing from that man coverage defense like you were alluding to earlier.
And it's not to be unexpected. I mean, however bad it looked on TV, it looked way worse on film.
Ooh.
It's hard for a receiver, to disappear on film. I mean, it's not hard, but wide receivers, number one receivers, don't usually flat-out disappear
on Doug film. Baldwin and Revis.
Baldwin beat him once, and it wasn't the pick play touchdown. It was another play that it was actually a big third down in the fourth quarter where it was right over the middle out of an empty set. Baldwin beat him, and Russell Wilson had his eyes on a deep outside receiver working against Simon, by the way, I guess it would have been a Browner. I was thinking a Seahawk defensive back. Working against Browner, though,
too.
Browner. Anyway, Ninkovich got pressure because Russell Wilson just didn't quite see Baldwin early enough. But it was only that one play that Baldwin looked like he had any chance against Revis.
Now, here's my question is if New England is so good at utilizing their wide receivers and their route combinations, why isn't Seattle doing a similar thing with their kind of slew of no-namers?
I wonder that myself because there has to be a reason for it. That's a great question. And if people want to criticize Daryl Bevell, that's the angle to go at.
Because these aren't completely opposite receiving cores. I mean,
no, they're very similar. If you gave Tom Brady Seattle's receivers, that offense would not change much. They'd lose the Gronkowski factor. That's a big deal. But schematically, the approach to football, and especially to the wide receivers, that would not change. I wonder myself, and I'd love to ask Bevell why he doesn't use more. That's called man-beater concepts. And so when we say a man-beater concept, we mean a concept. It's what it sounds like, a concept that by design beats man coverage. And examples are the stack releases with a receiver behind another, which forces the man defenders to back off. And that's why I'm defending the play design on the Russell Wilson interception that lost the game. Crossing patterns, any pick type of things.
Anything that throws a defender off his line.
Or puts a defender in the line of another defender. Where if you can make defenders have to worry about running into one another, you win on offense against man coverage. And that's what man beaters aim to do. Seattle does, even though they did it at the end of that game there, overall, they don't do a lot of it. And my guess is the reason why is they want to spread the field more and give Russell Wilson more options that way. Because if you think about it, first of all, when Seattle does do it, they do it kind of pretty well. I mean, like their slot wheel route stuff that they throw to Baldwin all season long, they did one to curse this game. It didn't go anywhere. But those plays have been successful for them. They are decent on stack releases. But if you think about why aren't they doing them more? If Wilson has five eligible targets spread across the entire field, that's where he's probably most dangerous extending the play. Because what you get with these man-beater concepts are defined reads. This is the Alex Smith stuff that we like to talk about, where there's one guy designed to get open by the man-beater, and that's where the ball is designed to go. If you're spreading out, then you've theoretically got all five guys running individual routes, so there's opportunities across the board. I think they do that because they want to extend plays and make it easier on Wilson late in the down, not early in the down.
It seemed like the Patriots actually made it pretty easy on Wilson in the pass rush, too. He seemed to have worlds of time back there. He could have joined your little 50 Shades of Grey book club there on the MMQB book tour.
Oh, like read the book during the
time? Yeah, he would have had plenty of time.
That's a force there. That's, you know, I was
waiting for that one a little bit.
You were waiting or you were rushing into it?
No, I wasn't rushing. That was
I'm almost done with the J.K. Rowling book, by the way. I've got 20 pages left.
Good. I hope you tweet out your progress throughout the week so we can keep
throughout tabs. The week, I'll be done when I get home after this.
Really?
You
told me to get here
reader.
Early, and it was because you wanted to get more reading in later tonight? That's absurd. We're going to have to settle this after the podcast.
If we'd gotten here late, I maybe wouldn't have read when I got home. It would have been too late.
Oh, you poor thing.
What was your question? I forget.
Russell Wilson, pass rush, didn't seem to really be there.
They mush rushed a little bit. I think they were trying to be a little more controlled with it. Keep in mind, New England also doesn't have great individual pass rushers anyway. I mean, Ninkovich can overachieve. He can be quicker than you expect, but he's not an edge burner. Chandler Jones is a dynamic, multifaceted player, but he's also not just a pure edge burner. So it's not like it was a big-time pass rush. They hardly blitzed. I don't know if they even blitzed at all. They maybe did. I think they did one or two man-free blitzes, so a five-man pass rush. Man-free being man-to-man with one free defender. But they didn't want to blitz them because they felt they could line up and play sound coverage across the board against these guys, probably especially given all the isolation routes that they do. And they were correct. To me, what was most interesting in the passing game on Seattle's side was all the ways that they kept eyes on Russell Wilson.
What's also intriguing in this game, though, is with that pass rush, when you brought that up, is that it seems like those big play runs from Wilson occurred when the other team blitzes and he makes one guy miss and he's gone.
That's the risk of a
anything.
Blitz.
You just leave him there in the pocket. He doesn't want to run away.
Yeah, they were – you could almost –
Don't poke the bee's nest and he'll just stay there.
You could almost say they encouraged Wilson to work late in the down and bet on that way rather than giving him a playmaking mentality early in the down, like what you're saying where he beats a guy. I mean, a good example was the one long run. It's the only read option keeper that Wilson had. He made Jamie Collins miss in the backfield. That's a great example of what you're talking about. Now, that's a running play, not a pass play, but the concept, the premise is the same. A defender in Wilson's face quickly, and it's almost an all-or-nothing combination at that point because if that defender doesn't get him, chances are the rest of the defense is not in position to help on him. And we saw that Wilson, I think, got 17 yards on that towards the end of the first half, if I'm not mistaken. But they did a great job with him. And we'll talk about the run game in a second, too, because they did a great job there, I thought. As far as the pass game, keeping eyes on Wilson – they had different guys spy him. It was not Jamie Collins very often. Collins, yeah, he played the tight end and man coverage a lot, the running back too a little bit, and he had an okay game. We'll talk about the run in a second. But they had the one I liked best that they did to keep a spy on Wilson. Hightower was involved often, but Devin McCourty, whenever Seattle went to, I think it was four wide receivers, even at times New England played dime, six defensive backs, against some of their three wide receiver concepts. And in a lot of those, McCourty, as one of the three safeties, was the spying defender, a lurker man. And Daron Harmon played back deep, which makes sense because you put your lesser guy further away from the ball would be the thinking there. I like that idea of having McCourty be the spy because you're matching speed for speed at that point.
I saw one of your tweets after you started watching the film that you were impressed with the run defense from the Patriots, but 162 yards on the ground for the Seahawks. Justify yourself a little bit there.
Justify myself.
You're on trial now.
Well, okay, so in 19 of them came on the Robert Turbin run, which is a good run. They did a great job with the concept on that.
30-something from Russell.
Okay, yeah. So Russell Wilson's big run also came right after the Turbin run, and that's what got that final drive in the first half going, because they went to a spread set with four receivers aligned almost right along the sidelines. And that widened the defense to the extent that New England only had five guys in the box. I'm talking about the Turbin 19-yard run at this point.
Okay.
So Turbin jump-starts the drive, and I think that jump-started the running game a little bit too, because Seattle was not super productive in the first half running the ball before that. As far as justifying myself, because Marshawn Lynch, he ran hard, he gained his yards. I never got the sense that Seattle dictated the game with their ground game, other than maybe halfway through the third quarter it was, where they got rolling a little bit. I believe that the field goal drive, I think it was, they got rolling a little bit out of their regular run concepts. But what New England did to minimize damage on that and really prevent big plays and force them to mount drives, which it's a tougher way to win that way, is they used both defensive tackles as three techniques. So they put them between the guard and the tackle. When you do that, if you think about it, and I just learned this past offseason, I learned this from a few coaches taught me. If you put both defensive tackles in the three techniques, then you occupy to some extent the guard and the tackle on offense. Well, if both of those guys are occupied, there's nobody to double team, because you need either a guard or a tackle to do a double team. A center can't be his own double team. And so you force the center to make one-on-one blocks at the second level, and you also prevent double teams in the ground game. When New England did that, and other teams have done that against read option looks before. In fact, Seattle did that to San Francisco in the NFC Championship game in 2012 in San Francisco. Not the NFC Championship, it was a regular season game, excuse me, I'm mistaken. But Seattle actually started doing this before all the other teams, and they laid the blueprint as a defense years ago, two or three years ago. And now other teams have copied them and used it against them, and that's what New England did. And the linebackers played much faster that way because there weren't double teams and they were shooting gaps by design. That varied from play to play.
Was Ninkovich also at times doing somewhat of like a contain? It seemed like he'd get past the line and just hang out, not even initiate there against Wilson for the read.
That was to take the option out of the read option.
Right.
Read option, you can make it not an option. If the DN hangs outside like that, the quarterback has to hand it off. Otherwise, he's going to have to make a defensive end miss in space. Which is a lot harder than it sounds in that scenario. So Chandler Jones did that a little bit. If the ball was to his side, if the play was to his side, and Ninkovich did that as well.
Leading up into the game, you wrote about the wheel route and how the Seahawks are able to incorporate that with both Lynch and Doug Baldwin. Was this the case? Did they really go to the wheel route much?
No, not a whole lot. They didn't do it a whole lot. I thought they would have done it a little bit more. Obviously, I wrote about it. They had a good shot on it. Curse beat Butler on a wheel route in the third quarter. Maybe it was the fourth quarter. It was a big drop, and it wasn't really a drop. It was an incomplete pass on
third
down.
Oh, no, I remember that.
Yeah.
Wasn't that right before the cleat catch? That drop, I think, was right before the bumbling cleat catch.
I think it was the series before that.
Okay.
We'll have to check. I think it was the series, because I'm pretty sure, I could be mistaken, but I remember in my notes saying this was a huge, I'm pretty sure it was a third down.
Okay.
Either whatever it would have been a game changer had he completed the catch, and Butler recovered just enough and altered the play. But that was the only time, and that was a good wheel route design. Usually they do it with two receivers to the same side of the field. On that one, they did it with three receivers, and they had Luke Wilson run a shallow cross that acted as the pick route. And that's a good guy to use as a picker, because he's much bigger than everybody else. He's bigger than Doug Baldwin, for example, who would have been the other guy picking. They got what they wanted there, just the play didn't happen to work out. You know, New England also did a lot of wheel routes, and Seattle defended them extremely well.
You know, when
nobody did wheel routes well in this game. It was all good defense.
When you're mentioning all of this, especially with the wheel routes, something that made Seattle pretty special in a lot of these games this season, did it feel like New England was the only team actually making adjustments in this one? I mean, the Browner switch, the elimination of the option in the zone read that you talked about, not a lot of creativity from the Seahawks going on.
Yeah, other than with Maxwell having to take the slot because of the injury to Lane, which that's not
forced.
Really an adjustment. Yeah. You could argue the Browner one's forced because Kyle Arrington just couldn't compete with Chris
Matthews.
Except
Browner asked to.
Yeah, no, you're right.
I
yeah,
like
he
that.
Did ask to.
That's bold.
It's bold. Well, he went to his DB coach. He didn't go up to Bill Belichick.
No, no.
But
no,
that's
one
the protocol.
To Bill
that's
the game.
That's the protocol anyway. So that's no need to take a shot at Browner there. New England does a lot. They vary their man coverage concepts throughout the game, and part of that I think is because they wanted to change up their spy tactics. You got to change a spy against Wilson, because if he starts to get a beat on who the spy is, then he knows who to manipulate and how to react on everything. Then he becomes the aggressor. So
that's why it wasn't frequently Jamie Collins.
Right, and Collins really, I think they wanted Collins in coverage. I think they just felt strongly about that, because Collins, to my recollection, I could be wrong, he only spied on one time, one down that I remember in the first half. It could have been more if it was not an impactful, you know, play. Something else happened. It wasn't a factor in the play, but I only noticed him spying once.
Well, yeah, watching the broadcast, I remember saying, why isn't Jamie Collins isn't putting eyes on Russell Wilson even without going through the
field? Well, because I thought, okay, Collins will spy because he's their most athletic guy. And he did a good job on the one play he did spy. I could see where it would work. But I think they felt Hightower runs well enough and will have other eyes on him from somewhere else. There were times, I mean, the first third down of the game, Hightower spied and Chandler Jones from defensive end also spied. He dropped out. So they rushed three, de facto three-man rush a lot of the time in this game, or more often than just a few. And they had different guys spying and multiple guys at a time. So that almost, you could say, two guys equals one Jamie Collins in certain scenarios. And also, if you're going to put Devin McCourty on him, as great an athlete as Collins is, and we you know, are effusive about him, McCourty's a better athlete than Collins in terms
certainly.
Of running around. I mean, a safety's better than a linebacker running around, a free safety especially, and a converted cornerback. So they had different guys on, but they felt they had enough athletes. Another guy who played a lot, he didn't spy, but he was a part of these packages, and he held down his fort whenever he needed to, was Patrick Chung. He was in there quite a bit.
As a spy?
No, he didn't spy, but he was in on the spy tactics.
Oh,
as
gotcha.
Like a defender. You know, he was a reliable defender out of – when you go to these – if you're going to change your spy, you almost need to be in a dime package, because you need to have different potential spies on the field. You can't just
– instead of just switching
if you line up
in
base, yeah. There's only like two or three guys in your base D who are athletic enough to spy, and probably only two, McCourty and Jamie Collins. But if you go dime and you throw Daron Harmon on the field as well, you put Patrick Chung on there, and you have more versatile looks inside, you have more dimension.
Now,
so Patrick Chung, I'm just saying, he made their dime packages solid.
Now, Wilson will get quite a bit of grief for that last interception, whether he should or not, but he actually threw the ball pretty well in this one.
Yeah, he did. I thought he played a good game. I thought he played well
especially
enough to win.
Especially on the deep ball.
He's always good on the deep ball.
Yeah.
He's one of the best deep ball. You know who else
his
is really?
Touch. It's just you. It's not
his
like
touch
he's moving
is
very fast. It's just a touch.
Yeah, he's got great touch on the deep ball. The other guy who throws it extremely well is RG3.
Yeah.
It's these two mobile QBs, and if an offense can figure out how to use that to their advantage, and Seattle has more example that Daryl Bevel's not an idiot, then it works out real well for him. Think about how tough, just conceptually, if you've got a mobile quarterback, and I didn't mean to bring up RG3, like, let's expound on Wilson, because RG3's got other issues that we all know about.
We'll talk about him over this offseason.
You think he'll come up?
A few times, maybe.
If you have a QB that can run around and throw deep, think about how much football field the defense is therefore forced to account for. I mean, that's just it's
all of
versus
it.
Yeah, versus I mean, and I think Peyton Manning's got plenty left. I'm sure we'll talk about him in the offseason. Plenty left for one or two more years. I mean, he can have two, you know, a good few years. But think about how much easier Manning is tactically to defend than Russell Wilson, because Manning's his arm's declining and he can't run around.
Or like
there's less field to defend with Manning than
Phillip
Wilson.
Rivers in that Week 16 game, I think it was like a 3rd and 4, and this was them
playing
for the playoffs.
Who are they playing?
I can't remember, but he scrambles in that final four or five minutes, and he's trying to get 4 yards and hobbling along and just gets creamed right before the line. And
he's not the most natural.
Example.
Oh, the Niners. That was Saturday night game.
Yeah, there you
yeah,
go.
Yeah, he's not the most natural runner. Yeah, I mean, Rivers, I don't mean to say like these guys are easy to defend. I think the point is, look how hard tactically Russell Wilson is to defend, because he can throw deep and run anywhere.
Is it a myth that he can't be a pocket passer?
No, it's not a myth, because he cannot see. People want to say, oh, that doesn't matter. You know, he's proven them all wrong. No, he's not. They just adjust their offense for him. Another example of Daryl Bevel not being an idiot, by the way. They have to move the pockets. He has to move a lot within the pockets. there are certain plays where he just doesn't see. I mean, that Baldwin play, I wonder if he couldn't see over the line well enough to see Baldwin get open against Revis. I didn't want to say it, but I wonder on the Lockett one if that's part of the reason he doesn't see Butler. I could be wrong. I mean, I don't think it was true on that one. But the fact that we're talking about it, it's true that Russell Wilson cannot see. A guy can't – you don't go prove someone wrong. He's not going to suddenly be 6 foot five when
he
drops back to
pass. These linemen are 6'7", 6'8".
Right. We're talking about a 5 foot 10 and 5'8" guy, and that's how you know he's short when you have to add the 5'8" little man kind of thing.
I think this is the third podcast you've pointed out.
I mean,
out
it's
the
second one. Probably the other one we were off air. but we're talking about a little guy, and we're saying, well, yeah, but no, he can see. He can do it wrong. Tell me why. Tell me why the 5'10 guy – can see over the 6'7" guy. Explain to me how that works.
I don't think he can.
So he has to see around him, or he has to
run away.
Yeah, and then change the passing angles, change the look. I mean, it's not like he can't play QB, but that's – and this is why we don't see other 5'10 quarterbacks, because Drew Brees, who's a big-time exception to the rule
he's going to have neck problems the rest of his life. The way he cranes up his neck, I think it's hilarious sometimes watching him.
It almost looks like his face mask has slid up into his eyesight, yeah, and he's trying to get his helmet back in position or something. I've always thought that he looks goofy doing it, but it's worked well for him. He's an exception to the rule. And also, 6 foot is taller than 5'10 and 5'8". I mean, just a little bit taller. So, but you can't expect him to just all of a sudden see.
One of those guys that Russell Wilson has actually had to run away from, see over, see around, Luke Kuechly in this postseason.
Yeah, and because Super Bowl week, a lot of these guys are making the rounds doing their promo stuff, and Gatorade's its 50th year, so they had a lot of guys pumping the 50th year anniversary, and that means we got to cross paths with Kuechly, and so I talked to him last week. But as we said on the podcast earlier this week, it's a general football discussion, so we could play it now.
Sure.
Talking with Luke Kuechly of the Carolina Panthers. Luke, you're here with Gatorade, which is celebrating its 50th year. Hard to believe. What's your history with Gatorade?
Yeah, so, you know, when I came in, as a rookie, when I got down for combine training, one of the first things I did was work with the Gatorade Sports Science Institute. And, you know, growing up, you know about Gatorade as a means of hydration. But when you really break it down and you look at what they can do for you, you know, they got pre-workout stuff you can take after workout, protein shakes, things, you know, like the little chews you can do during the workout to give you a little bit of a boost. It's more of a whole encompassing thing rather than just one hydration thing. And I think that's one thing I've learned, how much inner hydration and nutrition can really, really benefit you in what you're doing on the field.
Yeah, and that's something that's become more conscious around the NFL in the last 15 or 20 years as well. Let's get on the field stuff with the NFL. And in Carolina, you guys do a lot of the double A-gap stuff. You're a zone-based team, so not a lot of blitzing, but you still show that blitz look and influence protection. On those inside blitz looks where you don't come and you drop back into coverage, how much more challenging is that for you as a linebacker versus if you just had to start out in coverage to begin with?
When you think about it, you're up in the A-gap, you're almost a little bit blind. You can't really see the whole formation. You're in that A-gap trying to show as much as you can a blitzing look. And then, you know, at the snap of the ball, you got to get back, you know, 12, 15 yards into coverage. And, you know, it's somewhat of a challenge, but I think it gives us a good look up front. And as long as you do some good studying during the week and understand route concepts and down and distance and what they like running in certain situations, you get out of there and kind of feel the pattern routes and kind of go from there. But I think it kind of gives us some good diversity in what we're trying to do as far as blitzing goes.
And I've talked with a lot of coaches over the last 2 years about mobile quarterbacks versus really good pocket quarterbacks. And the example I've used with them is Colin Kaepernick versus Peyton Manning, and which guy would you rather scheme for and play against? And a very, very solid majority of the coaches have told me they'd rather face Manning, which is a little surprising to me, but I'm not going to ask you to speak directly about either of these guys, but conceptually, as the field general of a very good defense, do you agree with the coaches? Would you rather face a really good pocket quarterback versus a sporadic mobile quarterback?
Yeah, when you look at it, you got to look at what each player does well, and you look at, you know, a mobile guy, obviously they can throw the ball, and then the running game, you got to prepare for that a little bit more. It's a little bit more unconventional how they run the ball with the zone reads and the different ways they read defenses and things of that nature. As far as, you know, the pocket guy goes, that's really all you got to worry about. Maybe you got to worry about him scrambling a little bit, but he's not necessarily a threat to run like some of these mobile guys are. So I'm with the majority of those guys, like you talked about. The pocket guys are easier to scheme for. They're not necessarily easier to play against. So you just got to make sure you're on top of your game, because those runners can you know, one beat you with the arm and then two beat you with the feet, which makes it a little bit more difficult.
Right, and when a guy is easier to scheme for but not play against, what's the advantage there? I mean, okay, he's easier to scheme for. Now what? How do you take advantage of that? Where do you get the benefit during the week?
I just think you can concentrate more on, you know, when you look at the run game, it's just more of, you know, running back runs, you know, zone schemes, power schemes, whatever you have during that week versus, you know, when you look at a team, you know, like we play Seattle, you know, even our team with Cam. It's not just a run with the running back. You got to account for the quarterback, and there's extra gaps when quarterbacks run the ball. Sometimes they have more than you can protect. You just got to make sure on your assignment. You're right. You know, Philly does a good job creating gap assignments that are difficult. And you know, like I said, the mobile guys can do that, and the stationary guys are more of drop back pass and hand the ball to the running back, which makes things a little bit easier as far as your game plan goes.
And you guys faced Seattle twice this year, and for the most part, you played them tough. And last year, you faced San Francisco twice, and you played them pretty tough. Why have the Panthers been so good against these dynamic mobile QBs?
Well, for us, luckily, we get a look at it during camp and OTAs, you know, with Cam and what we do on offense. You know, we run sort of the same stuff that, you know, San Fran and Seattle runs with the Q pulls and the reads and the little pop passes they can run off their offense to their tight end. So, you know, we get a good look at it during OTAs and camp and somewhat during this season, but then I think, you know, it really comes down to our coaches, and, you know, they do a good job of breaking stuff down and figuring out what's going to work for us and what's going to be beneficial to us during the week. And I think the practice habits are the big thing too. They find out what's important, they stress what's important, and then at the end of the day, they kind of just let us read and react.
You and Thomas Davis have become a very good nickel linebacking tandem, and really in today's NFL, the nickel defense, the nickel package, it's the predominant package. It's almost the new base package. You've been able to stop the run out of nickel. You have to in today's league. Generally speaking, what are the biggest differences between defending the run out of a nickel package versus out of a base 4-3?
A lot of times in nickel package, it's, you know, it's one back runs. You look at the nickel, usually it's 11 personnel. Sometimes, you know, you look at 12 personnel when nickel's in the game. So a lot of the fits are solely on the linebackers and the guys up front. Sometimes you get the nickel and the fit, but a lot of times it's the linebackers and the four guys in the front of the defense that have to worry about the run. So, you know, you got to be responsible for your gaps. A lot of times it's, you know, one guy, one gap, or sometimes you got to bounce between two gaps. But majority of the time when you look at it, you just got to play responsible. Run fits, make sure you're in the right spot, and the six guys in the front have to make sure they're doing a good job against the run.
Many people, and myself included, believe you're the best inside linebacker in the league, and you probably don't think of things in those terms, and my guess is you're just focused on getting better. So let me get you out on this question. If you had to identify one very specific element of your game in which you'd like to focus on improving this offseason, what would it be?
I think for me, you know, blitzing, and, you know, I'm going to throw two in there. I think they're equally the same. I think, you know, blitz technique and making sure I have an effective way to get to the quarterback and create pressure when, you know, blitz is called. If I'm not getting there, I'm kind of hanging the rest of the defense out to dry. There's less guys coverage, you know, with a backer blitz. And the other one is pass coverage. You got to be able to do that. And, you know, that's half your job description. You got to be able to play the run, and then you got to play the pass equally as well. And, you know, I think I got better this year in pass coverage. At the same time, you look around the league and some guys that do it exceptionally well, and you got to try to get to that level.
Thanks once again to Luke Kuechly. Now that we've hammered out the Super Bowl matchup, gotten through that interview, let's move on around the league. Since we last recorded, James Betcher was promoted within the Cardinals organization to replace Todd Bowles as defensive coordinator. Does this make sense?
It does. Yes and no. It does in that they wanted a younger D coordinator, and I think they wanted to promote from within. It doesn't in that I know for certain they also wanted an older defensive coach, a more experienced coach, to kind of help along with the process. Sort of like what Tom, you know, how Tom Moore is some senior assistant or whatever on offense.
Sure.
He has a big hand in what goes on there, I think. I mean, Bruce Arians runs that show, obviously, but Tom Moore is not there to do nothing. He has a role. He's a factor. I know they wanted something like that on defense. And there were guys out there, you know, they talked very long with Dick LeBeau, and I thought that was going to happen. But then he wound up going to Tennessee, and I don't know what happened there. But they absolutely wanted someone like Dick LeBeau, and that would have been a perfect guy to have fill that role.
Yeah, especially with his past with Bruce Arians. And then right. Bruce Arians is a hands-off defense kind of coach, right?
I believe so, yeah. I mean, he certainly was with Todd Bowles, and he's so hands-on with the offense that he almost would have to be hands-off with the defense.
Can it be assumed that no one's going to be able to elevate players the way that Bowles was able to this last year with the injuries, the suspensions, you know, guys like Larry Foote?
Larry Foote will be back, and he's going to be a player's coach for them, I've heard.
Okay.
Which is very unusual.
Smart.
And they've told him the hardest thing you'll have to do is cut yourself eventually. Now, he's not going to be cutting himself any time. I would hope he makes a team this year. I mean,
especially his own.
Yeah. I mean, especially – and position coaches do have more of a say in that than people realize, too, a lot of them. I don't know if he'll have that kind of say, but they're going to have him do some – now, Bob Sanders was brought in to coach – the linebackers. He was former defensive coordinator in Green Bay about 8 years ago, and he's been a linebacker coach since. So Larry Foote's not going to be acting on his own, but he's being talked about as a player's coach in there. What was your question? If it can work out with Bowles, or
can
like
he
the way
elevate
did with Bowles?
People the way that Bowles was?
When you have those man-to-man corners, you can do a lot with your scheme. You can try different things. And I think so. They're going to have the man-to-man corners. Cromartie's a free agent, but they're going to have Patrick Peterson back, and maybe
they still got Tyrann Mathieu to play with.
Yeah, and so you have that kind of piece, but I think the other one is Larry Foote gives them the veteran presence, and that sets up a lot of their blitz packages. So you can play man-to-man outside, and you have someone to coordinate on the field inside, which is where your blitzes come from. I think it could work still. I don't know this new guy, this Betcher. I don't know him, but I think – he has the personnel to try to keep continuing with what they've done over there.
Yeah, he inherits one of the deepest secondaries in the NFL.
Yeah, and it's a team that's going to be healthier on defense, although I guess because they're going to have Darnell Dockett back.
Yep.
You know, by the way, he was supposed to sit next to me at the Super Bowl.
Really?
Yeah, he was going to –
that would have probably been miserable for him. You wouldn't have shut the hell up.
No, it would have been miserable for me. Darnell Dockett's a 300-pounder with a personality to match. And – the Super Bowl seating gets so confined because you sit in the stands, like the regular stands, but everyone brings their bags and all their stuff. It just feels very tight. And I'm not griping about a Super Bowl seat. I mean, that was a $9,000 seat, as I understand it. But that would have been very tight. Emily Kaplan and I were both elated because he was sitting between us.
Hopefully
so we
he's
got
not
an
a
empty,
listener.
So we went, that's fine, whatever. So how late are we in it? How late are we in it?
You don't think he's staying past 41?
I don't think the people that brought him into MMQB to be a guest writer for the week are staying past 41
oh,
either.
God.
So we're okay. We're all right.
All right.
He
I
did
so.
Write, and he wrote something for us this week, and it went real well. But I was so glad that he didn't wind up sitting next
I
to
like
me.
I like those this. Guest pieces, too. Not to blow smoke up the site, but.
Up the site? That's what you were going to say?
Yeah.
Yeah,
I was holding back a little bit.
Yeah,
I like them.
They help. They help our numbers, and they help our credibility
and our readers too. I think that should have been the premier concern: is they help your readers. Hey,
well,
Dan,
the readers and the numbers are the same thing.
Whatever. People are
your readers
numbers,
are mere
Andy.
Numbers
they're
to
not,
us.
We're not numbers, okay? Hey, Dan Quinn hasn't been in Atlanta long. Things seem to be getting interesting there with Arthur
Blank.
Oh, because
of the crowd noise thing?
He admitted to it. He's like, what we've been doing over the last 2 years is wrong. It was like a very sketchy way of admitting to what had happened.
Yeah, so I guess you punish him and then move on about it.
Yeah, it's
or wait, do we need, or should we lead off the news, Nightly News and Good Morning America and USA Today and all the major news outlets? Should this be a leading story?
So you just listed Nightly News because you were almost on their broadcast.
I did not. I didn't say Nightly
bitter.
News.
Yes,
I didn't
you
say
did.
Nightly News.
You said Nightly News. Oh, Evening News. That's what it's called.
Ah,
there we go.
See?
Shout out NBC. Maybe next time.
Yeah, no. This is probably the same kind of thing as Deflategate, isn't it? I mean, not the same thing, but like it's – There are people who believe and make a decent case for this being a bigger deal than Deflategate. Because I don't understand why they don't let them just do whatever they want with the footballs. I mean, that's only going to go so far. Eventually,
yeah.
Science will dictate that they don't want to deflate them all the way, right?
Yeah.
And a crowd noise, that's different. I mean, there's almost no limit on that. Like, there's no, you know, and that impacts an entire team, not just the guy throwing the ball. So.
And the report was that it was happening when the opposing offense was going into the huddle or trying to get the play call off.
Yeah, well, that would be the time to do it, I would hope. What if a team got caught pumping in crowd noise when its own offense was on the field? Would they get
a compensatory draft pick?
Yeah. They get an extra pick the other way?
You're just that dumb. I think we'll give you an extra pick, Atlanta.
What's the punishment going to be here? It's, I mean...
Could be a pick. It's
well, of course,
I'm
yeah.
A
I think it, if it is a
pick.
If it is a pick, what's the what pick?
Third round, fourth round.
See, you're third round would be a big deal.
You're not going to lose a first round pick.
Patriots did for Spygate.
That's worse.
This is worse.
You think the crowd noise is worse than having all tape the, of your team you're going up against in the Super Bowl? Rumored
that was not
rumored.
That's not what they were punished for. They were punished for taping opponents.
They were
signals.
They were caught. They were finally tried in 2007.
Yeah, but Bill Belichick's point, I'm not stuttering. Bill Belichick's point last week was that we taped the signals that the opponent's, lead signal man was making in front of 80,000 people. He's right. Everybody, and they weren't the only ones taping signals. I bet the Falcons were the only ones pumping in crowd noises.
Weren't the Seattle Seahawks suspected of that a couple of years ago?
Every team's been suspected of it at
That's
some
true.
Point.
Everyone's suspected of cheating once in a while. Hey, you mentioned Deflategate. One of the key components of Deflategate for a while was DeQuell Jackson. He was arrested.
Oh, that was a very – that was – wow.
That's prime segue right there.
Yeah, that is. That wasn't even on the outline.
And you just blew it up.
I know it. I don't care. I mean, he got arrested because he got into it with a pizza guy, right?
No, you think it was a pizza guy. I don't know what the guy's – you know his occupation?
I thought I heard it was a pizza guy.
Oh, I heard it was just like two guys looking for a parking spot.
Well, let's – hold on.
Should we clarify?
We probably
should
have done that before we started. And Google, pizza delivery guy.
Wow. Yep. Really bold, DeQuell Jackson. No, we actually talked about
this. Will go away. This will be nothing.
We actually talked about this before the show. You were more outraged that the pizza guy was in the way of DeQuell Jackson, a key piece to the Colts defense.
I didn't know. I did not take that point of view. No, what are you doing? No. No, I didn't say that. It's wrong to hit anybody.
Of course, but he was a big piece of this team.
No pun intended.
Oh. That's bad.
Yeah.
You can't say that.
Yeah, I can. We're talking about, look, he probably shouldn't have done it. Everyone's probably acting out of line. He'll get fined a little bit. The league will roll its eyes because of the fine. We'll forget about this.
Yeah, he signed it.
Unless it was a female delivery person, it's not a big deal. Not in the league's eyes.
Yeah, probably not.
I hate to say that, but it's what's going to happen. Are they going to suspend DeQuell Jackson over this?
Over a pizza guy? Just a dude?
Well, no, I'm not saying – I don't mean it like that. I don't mean like that. But I'm just – I mean, what's going to – this is – we're officially in the offseason now.
I'm more concerned with DeQuell Jackson, 4 years, $22 million in March, needing a space that bad.
Needing a parking space?
Yeah. Like, what's
wrong? I'm trying to think if we
you?
Can do like a cap space, parking space pun now.
Oh, my God.
Well, who knows? I mean, maybe it was a principle of the thing, and I'm not justifying fighting, but maybe the hot-headed side of him thought, we don't even know what happened. We probably shouldn't even be talking about
it. You just naturally take a football player's side no matter what?
No. No. Okay. But, I mean, we've all been frustrated. Okay. I don't know.
We've all gotten hungry. Maybe
this isn't going well. I don't know why we've gotten it. This is my fault.
Yeah, okay.
I steered us wrong.
Now, on a much more serious note, there were a few other arrests, and especially this one being the most surprising. Packers defensive tackle LaTroy Guyon was caught with over $190,000 in cash, 357 grams of weed, and a semi-automatic 9mm handgun. That's insane.
He's done. Because he's a free – well, and here's why he's done. He's a free agent this year. And I thought they would – we talked about it a few weeks ago. I thought they'd re-sign him instead of Rodgers. I think you can get – Guyon at a little bit of a better rate than Rodgers.
They paid him like $1 million last year.
I know, and he earned more than that, and he was going to get paid more than that. Much more than – how much did you say he had on him?
$190,000.
Yeah, he's going to make a lot more than that in football. He was. But I think he's hard to re-sign now without knowing what happened. But you know how certain stories you just can tell up front that this is bad? Like, I remember the Aaron Hernandez, and I'm not comparing it to this.
No.
But I remember the Aaron Hernandez story when it first broke, and I thought, we're never going to see him again. I don't know how it's going to happen, but I don't think he'll ever play football again. I get the sense about that. I get that sense with this
Maybe
one.
I haven't been paying attention to the news enough, but I haven't seen – I feel like this should be everywhere, right? This is.
Oh, with all this
– No, I mean this particular
story?
Case. I mean,
because – You mean the LaTroy Guyon story?
Yeah, we've heard about all the crazy stuff that's been going on in the league. I mean – The stuff, the reports about Greg Hardy and the bed of guns and stuff like that, and then
yeah, but that
like
involved
this.
that was part of the players' domestic violence and people's safety issue. I don't know. I mean, here's what we do know. He's now a very complicated player to sign to your team. And is he good enough on the field to be a complicated player on your roster? And the answer is, as well as he played last year, the answer is no.
I don't think anyone's worth that.
There are some guys that are worth that.
In this league?
That are worth, well, I mean, not that you'd want these kind of guys, but there are some guys that are, it's worth feeling them out, waiting it out, seeing how it goes. You know, this is pretty extreme. I grant you that.
It is.
But, and I don't want to name names like, well, what if this guy had done it or that? But there are certain guys, there's a handful of guys that it's worth waiting this kind of thing out.
And then moving on, another arrest for Joseph Randall, Dallas Cowboys running back. He was caught with possession of marijuana in his hometown of Wichita. And this is now his second arrest in a year, the shoplifting case.
Yeah, he's had some weird, he sounds like he's immature. And it's the same kind of thing as Guyon in terms of how you look at it. Like, is he worth the trouble? Because the headline says Joseph Randall arrested again. And it says Cowboys running back Joseph Randall arrested again. That's not a good look for the team. Now, the Cowboys have, you know, it's not like this is totally unfamiliar. I remember 20 years ago that this kind of thing, it was a weird week if it didn't happen in Dallas. You wonder if something had gone wrong. So Jerry Jones can probably deal with that. And I think Randall was going to be part of their plans because DeMarco Murray is likely not back there.
Yeah, that's crazy, especially since he hasn't seen the field a ton. But
who, Randall?
Yeah.
But when he does see it, he's got some he reminds me of, maybe it's because he wears 21. It probably is. But he reminds me of Julius Jones.
Oh, okay.
I almost said
Julio. I like Julius Jones.
I liked him too. I liked him a lot. But he never quite turned out to be the guy they thought he would be. I think Randall was in the plans. Now he becomes a little bit complicated. This happened early in the offseason, though. My guess is this one goes away.
He just blows over, too?
This is strike two. Strike two. I mean, that's my guess. Without knowing the details, and let's kind of announce what we're doing here, because there will be more offseason arrests, and we're going to keep doing this podcast. We're not going to speculate about the legality of any of this. But on the field, this does have an impact. So we're going to try to look at what happens on the field with these guys. Like Guyon, I think, is off the field. I think he's done. I think Randall will be back and with two strikes.
Big impact on the field, too. Josh Gordon, more problems there. We've heard about that for the last, 2.5 years now? And suspended for all of next season.
Yeah, and that one really stinks.
That's such a shame. He's incredible to watch.
He is. He's as good as anybody in the league at his position. I wonder how good he'll be when he gets back, because he's only 23, I think, now, which is hard to understand because he feels like he's been around like 5 years.
So, but for a guy that's failed reportedly a drug test every year since he was like 14, when does he get the done stamp? I mean,
get his done stamp. It's going to be the same way Chris Carter got his, in that he's going to be done to certain teams, probably the team that took him and had to deal with the headaches the most. And then what does he do with the second chance, or in his case, the 22nd chance that he gets somewhere else? I mean, that's the best I can think of, because I'm not quite sure. I mean, I wrote in the Sports Illustrated magazine, and this was, they actually got edited out because this happened the day before we went to press. But I had it originally in there that the Browns' best bet might just be to deal with Josh Gordon's headaches, because, I mean, they need a receiver like that. They're probably going to lose Jordan Cameron.
He wants out. Johnny Manziel's in rehab, and now...
Right. I mean, the Browns, and I wouldn't count the Manziel thing for anything, because
another headache. A few headaches makes a migraine.
No question. Well, I'm very good at that.
You got to scoff off those little things.
He'll be 24 in April. He came in the league in 2012 in the supplemental draft because he had issues. I don't know what happens next with him. I'm not going to sit here and be one of those people that says, I hope he gets a help and all that. I mean, obviously, I want the best for it. I want the best for anybody. I have no idea what happens next with him, but I know this. I would take a chance on him. I'd take him on my team when he's ready to go.
We both love the best possible product that can be, excuse me, on the field. And when these guys are taken off the field,
Yeah, exactly. That's well said.
That's the whole point.
It's football is more exciting and more fun with a guy like Josh Gordon, talent-wise, with the output he can do on the field. It's more fun when it's out there on the field.
Now, this is a problem on and off the field in the football respect. Ray Farmer apparently being investigated now for texting the coaching staff during games, certain plays. What is going on in Cleveland? They just can't get out of their own way. They can't just do things right.
See, that to me seems like a very minor violation. Like, they're being investigated.
And why would he do it? They don't want texts from plays from Ray Farmer.
They have a coordinator. Well, and the guy who got the text is no longer there. He chose to leave.
There you go.
Shanahan. So Cleveland's a problematic situation. The biggest issue they have is their quarterback situation still. And all of that, the quarterback scenario is almost a snapshot of what's wrong with the franchise. They totally drafted the wrong guy. Honestly, last year in the first round, it would have – here's how bad that draft was. It would have been better to pass on their pick than to use their first-round pick last year because they wound up using it on Johnny Manziel.
Yeah, Johnny Manziel and Justin Gilbert.
Gilbert's had some trouble,
some people
too,
are calling them both busts already.
Well, Gilbert did not get on the field. Kawan Williams got on the field, an undrafted rookie ahead of him. So it's not like the rookies weren't learning there in Cleveland. Kawan Williams just was a better player than Gilbert. To me, that's very upsetting or very disconcerting.
You know, personally, you say that their biggest problem is their quarterback situation. I don't think anything on the field is sustainable unless the front office and coaching staff and that kind of thing is in place. You know, if there's quicksand in the front office and with all those different parties, I don't think that you can fake it very long on the field.
I don't think you can either, because if you get so many agendas going, I mean, if your offensive coordinator and your general manager are not on the same page at all, then how do you build?
You can't.
Tell me what you do. I mean, who do you get at quarterback and how do you use them? And that seemed to be the problem that they had here. They got a quarterback that the people who actually had to coach him didn't want anything to do with, and then the people who had to coach him had trouble using him because they knew that he had limitations, and now the guys that drafted him aren't happy about it.
On a more positive note, a little bit less depressing, I guess, out of all this news, we're talking a little bit about some of these mega deals from quarterbacks that were signed 4 or 5 years back. One of them in particular, Drew Brees and the Saints. This might be a real decision for the Saints as he comes into the latter portion of that deal. He has a $26.4 million cap hit to the Saints in 2015, and it's $27.4 million in 2016. Do the Saints naturally have to extend the contract for this 36-year-old quarterback?
It would be restructured in somehow. They could extend it, and then that would help him kick the can down the road more with signing bonus money and all that kind of thing.
What's the point of restructuring it in the second to last year of this contract, though?
Those are the last two years left. I didn't understand that. Okay, I wasn't thinking. That's an interesting one then. Yeah, I just get so used to these quarterbacks having a bunch of years left on their deal.
You don't think about them actually getting into the end of these deals.
Signed,
oh, it'll go till 2022. We don't have to worry about it for a few decades.
Right. What do you do about that with Brees? I think you do extend them and then you take the hit in little increments after these next 2 years.
Yeah, over the next.
To be honest, I'm not a big cap guy. I understand the general concepts of it, but I'm not a cap aficionado.
Well, the next 2 years, it'll be, I mean, if he lives out this contract, I think it's 18.46 a year guaranteed. And so over those next 2 years, $36 million guaranteed for Brees.
Well, let's ask this. Let's keep because the big picture perspective is always the best one in this stuff.
Yeah.
Because the big picture is where the answer is held, and then the guys that make the contracts, and Mickey Loomis in this case, they have to react to what the answer from that big picture is.
And there's nothing in the waiting here for the Saints. There's not a quarterback of the future.
That's the big picture. Do you take Drew Brees off the Saints? So what happens now? So then they're going to have to reorganize the money. Because they're not going to go out there and find a different QB. They're not ready to just completely rebuild.
This is like a Kobe Bryant contract. In the end, it's going to cripple there's a lot of these quarterback deals that can, in the end, really hurt some of these teams now that they're reaching $100 million.
But keep in mind, there's new TV money coming in, and the salary cap's inflating by $10 million every year.
Or if you're the Lions, you can just raise your ticket prices, try to get Ndamukong Suh back.
Hey, I have no problem with teams raising their ticket prices. And I don't have any problem with them charging full price for the preseason games either.
It's capitalism.
Yeah, it's supply and demand, morons. I mean, it's just follow the money.
What was your favorite part of Super Bowl 49? I haven't even asked you that. That's how we'll put a bow on this.
Everything. Like the week or the
game? I'll tell you mine.
Okay.
Watching the NFL films, the celebration video they had on NFL Network, you know, that's running 50 times a day now. But Gronkowski screaming in the face with excitement into the face of Robert Kraft was one of the most incredible things.
That's your highlight from the Super Bowl?
Well, I just the experience kind of stuff. Not play-wise.
All right, I have to talk about stuff that doesn't matter.
Don't say like hanging out with friends and good
memories.
Well,
I did have a blast with that kind of thing.
Great food.
I had a beer with Dom Banks after the game that was a lot of fun. And it was only like the second beer I've had ever that I finished. I'm not a beer guy.
Really?
And the first one came the week before in Mobile. Wow. A Yingling for all you Philadelphia people.
Unbelievable. I guess I get them enough for both of us then, huh?
Yeah, very good. Yeah. No, John Engel's fine, folks. He's fine. The highlight, it is fun. You know, I've been there four times now, and you do start to see people you know, and it becomes more and more fun. We had a great time. I'm not going to say who it was, but there was a group of us that had a great time. There was a big-time NFL guy sitting in the restaurant we
were at.
What
does that mean? Like, works for the NFL? Or
nah, he's in a front office with considerable power.
Okay, what conference?
AFC.
What division?
Nope. Yeah, nope. And he looked ridiculous for a variety of reasons, and he wasn't toasted or anything like that. We had a great time laughing at him, quite frankly, just pointing and laughing, as you know, laughing at people, not like laughing at what he does or anything. But it was so much fun. Finally, someone from the group went over and pretended to be eager to meet him, and so we got to go through that whole charade. It was incredibly immature. I mean, I didn't realize how immature it was until I had to speak it out loud in general terms and hear, like, my God, what did we do for an hour that night? That was ridiculous.
Good work.
Yeah.
Great, great trip. Hopefully MMQB sends you back to there, or sends you to the next one, huh? Super Bowl 50 in Santa Clara, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think I've earned it.
Maybe. All right, that's all we have for you this week. Remember to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Just search MMQB. You can follow Andy at Andy_Benoit or myself at Ingles Angle. Tune in next week.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.